have suggested if there's any place in the country where it might be possible, it is a state like Alaska.
Senator Murkowski gives serious consideration to a write-in campaign. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 16th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a biologist studies the walrus gathering on Alaska's northwest coast.
I'm surprised by one thing. Essentially all the animals here are adult females. I only see a very small number of yearling calves.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's weighing Alaska and its future as she considers whether or not to launch a write-in bid to keep her Senate seat. She won't say until tomorrow what she plans to do and says, in fact, she's still thinking about her options. But as APRN's Libby Casey reports, the senator does not sound like she's given up yet.
Lisa Murkowski admits running a write-in campaign is a long shot, and it would be an intense fight.
Think about the odds of taking on and being successful in a write-in campaign. They say the last senator that came to the Senate was Strom Thurmond. That happened before I was born. Now, a lot has happened in that time. We have communications tools that Strom Thurmond couldn't even dream of. You've got social networking. You have an ability to communicate with people now that does make it feasible. And I have suggested if there's any place in the country where it might be possible, it is a state like Alaska.
But, the senator says, it's an extraordinarily high hurdle.
I'm not much of a poker player, but the analogy that I've been using is I'm sitting there and I've been dealt a 6 and an 8. And the guy across from me has two kings showing. And I'm hoping for the 5, the 7, and the 9. But it is possible. And I think this is the hope that Alaskans have been sharing with me. That if it is possible, Lisa, will you give it a try? Will you give us a choice? And extraordinarily difficult. But again, I do feel a responsibility to my state.
Murkowski says that responsibility, she feels, is key right now. She says she's listening to the messages Alaskans are sending her. One was delivered in the bruising loss of the primary, but another is the outpouring of support she's gotten from people asking her to get back in the race. She says that's kept her weighing her options.
Believe you me, the easier path would be to pack it all up and go do something different. If I had not heard this call from Alaskans, I would not be deliberating as I am.
Murkowski says she agrees with many of the concerns of Tea Party groups, like wanting fiscal discipline, but she calls the Tea Party Express, the group that spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in Alaska supporting Joe Miller, an outside group that's one of the more extreme arms of the national movement. The Tea Party Express has slammed the senator in press releases this week, calling her a sore loser and saying it's ready to take her on if she does launch a write-in bid. Lisa Murkowski was back to work Thursday in the Senate. In between votes on the floor, she was greeted by colleague after colleague in private conversation. When she left the chamber to cross the hall, reporters swarmed her, peppering her with questions about the future. When asked what she was weighing, she simply said Alaska. A reporter asked if she's done any recent polling to see if a write-in bid is doable, and she said nope. And what was she hearing from her Senate colleagues?
We're just wondering what your colleagues are saying to you and what you're hearing from them.
Great support.
But Mitch McConnell, the top Republican in the Senate, has thrown his support to Joe Miller. When asked if Republicans were warmly welcoming Senator Murkowski back to Washington, he didn't have much to say.
She'll have to speak for herself. She's got a decision to make.
Have you gotten a chance to talk with her about that?
But McConnell wouldn't answer and walked stone-faced down the hall. One of Murkowski's few fellow Republican women in the Senate, Olympia Snow of Maine, was more forthcoming with praise.
Well, she's a great colleague. She's a friend as well. Obviously, we feel, very badly about it. She's served You know, anyway, she has been serving in the Senate with a great and outstanding distinction.
Murkowski's colleagues are trying to figure out what her absence would mean. She's the top Republican on the Energy Committee and also sits on Health and Education, Senate Indian Affairs, and for the past year held a slot on the powerful Appropriations Committee. One of her Democratic colleagues, Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, who leads Indian Affairs, called her defeat in the primary a loss to the United States Senate.
She's been great to work with. She, you know, is someone who is willing, when it's necessary, to work across political aisles. And apparently there's, in the Republican primaries these days, there's a huge penalty for people that are willing to do that. The problem is, the way the Senate is set up, the only way things can get done is if you have people with competing ideas, if they're willing to sit down and say, let's resolve this and reach compromise.
Even though Senate Republicans are now supporting primary winner Joe Miller, Murkowski says she is hearing encouraging words from her colleagues.
The encouragement is do what is right, and that's ultimately what you look to do. Do what is right for the people that you represent and your state and yourself, your family. And if you do what's right, all is good.
Murkowski plans to announce her decision in Alaska on Friday. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The major issue to be argued in this year's U.S. Senate race is how the winner of the general election will deal with the federal government's influence on the state's economy. Democrat Scott McAdams and Republican Tea Party candidate Joe Miller held their first formal debate today before the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. And McAdams came out on the attack. During his opening remarks, he read from a national pledge by the Citizens Council Against Government Waste that he said Miller signed, promising he would not seek earmarks that would serve only local needs. But McAdams argued that the pledge wasn't good for Alaska.
We're a young state. As a matter of equal footing, we deserve every dollar of our fair share brought into this economy. One-third of our state's economy is federal spending. As we continue to responsibly develop our natural resources, we will bring our state into maturity. But to say no to earmarks now is a threat to Alaska.
Miller, in his defense, says Alaska is going to experience a downturn in federal money, whether it's the result of national policies or the national economy. He says the state must be prepared by getting control over its own land and resources before the nation gets to what he calls the fiscal brink.
We enjoy the style of life, the lifestyle that we have. If we enjoy the level of economic activity we have in the state, we must prepare. We have to. And it is wholly irresponsible to, again, stick your head in the sand and vote along the lines of what both parties in Congress have done and drive us further into fiscal insanity.
Miller continued his arguments for getting control of the state's resources, pointing out the costs and effects of having to meet federal controls in building roads or mines or even exporting natural gas. And he repeated later that the federal money will stop, either through what he referred to as bankruptcy or through congressional decisions to restrain spending. At that point, he went back to his basic argument: Alaska must have control of its resources.
Overall, from the Democratic Party's perspective, development is a dirty word. The resources not there seem to be used, but to be conserved as effectively a national park. And in fact, the National Democrats essentially see the state as one huge national park. That is not the future for the state. It cannot be the future of the state. We've got to develop on those resources and the human resources that we have here in the state to move ourselves forward, and we've got to have vision. We can't be irresponsible in our approach.
McAdams continued with his point that federal investment is still important in Alaska, and the congressional delegation is critical in helping the state have a solid economic future.
No one understands our community's needs better than our local elected leaders and than our delegation. Don Young will tell you this. Ted Stevens would have told you this. I think even Lisa Murkowski would share this view. So if we cede our ability to ask for the needs that we understand in the local community to an agency, we have removed the decision-making power from the mayor's desk to the secretary's desk in Washington, D.C. I think that is wrong.
The debate covered a variety of issues, but the next one, scheduled in Fairbanks in mid-October, might be different, depending on whether incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski rejoins the race. McAdams said he would welcome her. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering a Barrow resident who helped form the North Slope Borough.
Nobody ever really had a harsh word about my dad. He was a good man.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. What would you do with an extra $56 a week? Well, that's how much you're spending if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day. At $8 a pack, that's $240 a month, $3,000 a year. Think about it, and think about quitting. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW. It's free, and it works. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
Tens of thousands of walrus are crowding onto a sandy stretch of beach on Alaska's northwest coast. The animals were forced to swim to shore after the sea ice they live on disappeared from the Chukchi Sea. It's a phenomenon that was unheard of 5 years ago, and scientists are trying to get a handle on what the dramatic change in behavior could mean for the species long term. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
When thousands of walrus are resting close by, it's important not to attract attention to yourself. So on a foggy evening earlier this month, Anthony Fischbach is in no hurry. The USGS biologist is creeping towards the animals. He's dressed in camouflage to blend into the greenish-brown landscape.
We're crawling on our knees now through grass up towards the haulout. The haulout's a bit smaller today. Must be out at sea. Several thousand walrus here, maybe 5,000. From here, it looks like they're all females. Certainly there's some young males in there too. I'm coming up to the edge of the grass where they've squished it down with their bodies. But now most of them are down in the sand.
The animals are packed shoulder to shoulder on the beach below. Fischbach calls it a wall of walrus. The walrus are gathering on Alaska's northwest coast for only the third time in human memory. The vast majority are females who float up to the Chukchi Sea each summer to fatten up and feed their young on clams that populate the seafloor. This time of year, they should be foraging from the sea ice over the productive waters of the continental shelf. Instead, they're stuck on land.
I'm surprised by one thing. Essentially all the animals here are adult females. There's a few adult males in there, here and there, some young males, but they're essentially all adult females. When you look at a group of adult female walruses, you expect to see about one in three with yearling calves. I only see a very small number of yearling calves. That makes me wonder what's happening with the calves.
Fischbach suspects walrus moms have a harder time keeping track of their pups once the sea ice disappears. Feeding the pups is also more difficult. From land, more animals have to compete for fewer resources that are farther away. Fischbach has been attaching satellite radio tags on the walrus to try to figure out how the animals are coping. He deploys the tags with a crossbow that embeds a hockey puck-sized transmitter into a thick piece of walrus skin. Back in his Anchorage office, Fischbach describes the information he gleans from the tags as walrus diaries.
It's a simple diary. I rested, I got in the water, I fed. You know, it all gets repeated in various combinations.
But that basic information is key to helping biologists figure out how walrus are coping with the dramatic changes in the Arctic Ocean.
You know, the big thing we're trying to do is try to understand what it costs a walrus to make a living when they're stuck on shore. Versus what it costs them to make a living when they're offshore on these small pans of ice or on the pack ice out in the middle of the Chukchi Sea.
The information is especially important as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decides whether walrus need protection under the Endangered Species Act. USGS biologist Chad Jay just released a report on the status of walrus the agency will study as it makes a decision.
I think it's a tough one because walruses are different than, say, polar bears in that, you know, polar bears have a real tough time when they're on shore, but walruses are able to come to shore for periods of time and still make a living. Although they could be stressed, it may not necessarily mean an end to walruses. So it's not quite as clear cut.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is expecting to make a decision on whether to list the walrus in January. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Two pilots are in relatively good condition following a mid-air collision yesterday in Dillingham. KDLG's Adam Kane has more.
Two Piper Super Cub float planes collided mid-air on takeoff from Shannon's Pond in Dillingham yesterday evening. Ken Shade was eating dinner when he saw the two planes collide.
Perfectly clear, beautiful, sunshiny day. I don't know. They should have seen each other.
Shade describes what he saw at Shannon's Pond.
They were both taken off in the same direction, and one just flew up into the other one.
According to Dillingham Interim Police Chief John Parker, emergency medical responders were able to access the accident with help from local citizens.
Some local citizens met the fire and EMS personnel, and they ferried the Dillingham fire and EMS personnel across the pond to the scene of the wreck. And apparently the aircraft had gone down there in the tundra. There was one injury, and the other pilot was ambulatory. So one of the pilots, the injured party, was transported to the local hospital and now is in Anchorage for additional medical care.
One of the planes was registered to and flown by Jim Willington, and according to eyewitness reports, Willington sustained only minor injuries and was able to walk out of the crashed plane and attempt to help the other pilot, who had been identified by witnesses as Justin Rogers. Rogers was believed to have injuries to his leg. Mike Fergus is a spokesperson with the Federal Aviation Administration. He says that it's not often that pilots walk away from a mid-air collision.
It's very seldom that you find mid-air collisions where both aircraft occupants just walk away from it. I mean, if you've got to have one, I suppose this is the least severe.
According to Ken Shade, after colliding, the planes lost control and spiraled into the ground nose first. Both planes ended up upside down. There was no fire as a result of the collision, although Shade says that a heavy smell of fuel was noticeable. It is still unknown what caused the mid-air collision, and Mike Fergus confirms that the FAA will investigate the incident.
The FAA, of course, will be investigating that, interviewing both pilots and anybody else that they feel may have some information bearing on it.
The FAA is also currently investigating another plane crash which took place on Wednesday. A Cessna 310 crashed approximately 4 miles to the north of Nome in marginal weather on Wednesday morning. The pilot and sole occupant was State Senator Donnie Olson. The airplane was destroyed. However, the senator was reportedly uninjured. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Democratic gubernatorial candidate Ethan Berkowitz announced the second part of his Alaskan ownership stake platform in Anchorage today. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, Berkowitz says he wants to give residents the opportunity to buy lifetime fishing, hunting, and trapping license.
Ethan Berkowitz and his campaign workers stood in a fog-bound Anchorage park this morning to illustrate what the Democratic nominee for governor describes as an innovative idea that could bring more money into state coffers.
We think it would bring in more because you'd have that initial surge when I'll let the legislature figure out exactly what they want to charge. But what will happen then is a lot of people will buy them and not use them, or buy them and move outside and then say, because we've got a license, we're going to come back up here. So it's going to, we're thinking, encourage, in terms of the military personnel that come here, there's about 25,000 military personnel, and folks will cycle through, but we want them to come back if they're not living here to visit, and it's a way of encouraging tourism as well.
Berkowitz says 27 states already have lifetime hunting and fishing licenses available in one form or another. He says the principle behind the idea is giving Alaskans more control over Alaskan resources. As outlined by Berkowitz, the lifetime hunting, fishing, or trapping license would be a one-time cost.
The way I envision this happening is that someone would go in and pay, we're projecting about 10 times the current annual cost for a hunting license or a fishing license or a combined license.
At present, an annual hunting license costs about $25, a fishing license $24, and a trapping license is less. Berkowitz wants to charge 10 times the cost of each for one lifetime license, or a combination of the three for about $490. Annual licenses will be available for those who desire them, and the state program of free licenses for those 60 or older will remain unchanged. Berkowitz says the lifetime license will remain valid for those who buy one as state residents and then move to another state. They will be allowed to use the license while on a trip back to Alaska.
I want to make clear, though, that all the costs for tags and special permits, those would apply in addition. If you want to get a king tag, you got to buy that on top of the permanent license here. If you come back as someone who no longer has residency, you've got to hire a guide, just the way anyone who doesn't live here would have to hire a guide. What this does, though, is give you the permanent license, and that's the idea behind it.
Berkowitz admits he has not involved the State Department of Fish and Game in discussions regarding the lifetime licenses. The innovation in hunting and fishing permits will take approval from the state legislature. Fish and Game's licensing supervisor, Kristen Wright, was not available for comment today. Berkowitz says Fish and Game has been short-funded in the past, and the lifetime license plan could result in a surge of money into the agency to pay for programs. Berkowitz has earlier unveiled a plan to allow Alaskans to invest permanent fund dividends in the proposed Alaska natural gas line to the lower 48 states. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Plans for a new state ferry in Alaska have hit a potentially serious roadblock. State transportation officials this week said they were told they cannot use federal money for the vessel. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The new ferry is estimated to cost about $120 million. State lawmakers appropriated half the money, and the federal government had approved the other half. But it turns out the state might not be able to use that federal money for the new vessel. Alaska Deputy Transportation Commissioner Jim Beadle gave a brief update on the issue to the Southeast Conference, a meeting of Southeast leaders in Petersburg. As Beadle explained it, the legislature's intent for the money conflicts with federal law.
They wanted an Alaska preference given to an Alaska shipyard. That is illegal to do if you're using federal money.
So this summer, the State Department of Transportation asked the Federal Highway Administration whether a bidder preference would be allowed if the state went ahead and gave up its federal funding. The Highway Administration's subsequent review led to another problem. The Federal Highway Administration told the state in mid-August that the environmental review for the project was invalid and failed to provide the necessary clearance. The review is required under the National Environmental Policy Act.
So they have notified us we don't have a project, and they've asked for the design money back.
The state could still use federal funding if it satisfies the environmental requirements. However, it would not be able to have a bid preference for in-state shipbuilders. State Senator Bert Stedman of Sitka thinks Alaska would be better off using its own money to build ferries with an Alaskan preference. Stedman suggested Alaska could still use the federal money for road projects in the rail belt while using state general funds for the Alaska-class ferry. Stedman, who co-chairs the Senate Finance Committee, says he's been discussing the issue with other lawmakers in the Parnell administration for a while. $60 million is a little less than half of what Southeast Alaska received in state capital money this past year. As for whether Alaska can afford spending another $60 million for a new ferry, Stedman has no doubts.
My response is we can't get within $60 million of our revenue forecast. We're dealing in billions. This is no big issue whatsoever for the state. We could put that in, pay for it, and actually we could fund another ferry if we decided to do it.
The new single-hull vessel would be 350 feet long and carry up to 500 passengers and about 70 vehicles. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
A man instrumental in the development and formation of the North Slope Borough has died. Borough resident Lloyd Avakana passed away on September 10th at the age of 91. Mr. Avakana worked diligently with Eben Hobson and others in Borough in the 1970s to put together a plan for a regional governmental structure. His son, Lawrence Avakana, says the men wanted to have local control rather than relying on Juneau for help in developing roads, sewer and water systems, and housing. Assisting other villages in their own local government formation was also part of what they worked to accomplish. Lawrence Avakana says his dad and the others realized that after a big oil find in Prudhoe Bay, they needed to work to be heard.
They were being left out of the process of getting funding through the taxation, so they wanted to do that to help the people of the North Slope. so that they can develop a more modern infrastructure within the villages.
Lloyd Avakana was born in 1919 in Barrow and grew up in a large traditional family. He was the second child of 11. He came from a long line of whalers and was a whaling captain himself. His son Lawrence recalls that after living in Anchorage for a number of years when he was young, the family moved back to Barrow when the elder Avakana retired from the National Guard. Lawrence was off at college then, but he says he made it back to Barrow and was introduced to the Inupiaq life of subsistence hunting and whaling.
Finally, I got to be able to whale with my father, and we did get a whale the last time we had a whaling crew. That was in 1976, and we caught a whale for our people. And that was the greatest experience in my life, and that helped me to connect back into my cultural identity of being Inupiaq.
Lloyd Avakana was a longtime member of the Ukipiagvik Presbyterian Church. In 1972, he convinced the national headquarters of the Presbyterian Church in Washington to help fund the startup costs for the North Slope Burrows formation. Avakana was the borough's first director of administration and finance. His son Lawrence says he was a deacon in the church and was a kind, gentle man who was always positive in his teaching young people about their heritage and culture.
And as being a hunter and to respect the animals, respect your neighbors, respect your elders, and help your children. And help other people's children to respect and to nurture them if there was any problems within the family. So they looked up to him as a guider, a guidance person, and a mentor to others.
Lloyd Avakana served in the U.S. Army and in the Alaska National Guard. At one time, he was the highest-ranking Inupiaq serviceman. His funeral and military honoring was today. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Adam Kane in Dillingham, Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHIA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHIA Fed. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.